Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and it's a great pleasure today to see so many people here in the audience, and I know that you'll enjoy today's lecture by Waleed Ali, who's well known to us all through many appearances on the media. But today he's here in his academic role. He is a lecturer in politics at Monash University, and in particular he's at the Global Terrorism Research Centre. He's a man of many parts. Some have described him as a Renaissance man, and I hope you'll give him a rock star welcome, because being in a rock band is one of his many talents. So please make welcome today Waleed Ali. Thank you.
Thanks for that. I don't know if you can take me seriously anymore after that. So, I am here in an academic capacity, and it's easy to tell because of the title, Multiculturalism, Assimilation and the Politics of Terror. This is an academic formula. When you don't know what you want to talk about, you put three words together and chuck "and" between the second and the third, and there's your title. And so that's what I've done. Subsequently to coming up with the title, though, I've thought about what I'm actually going to say, which is a good start. And I've decided there's lots of ways I could talk about this, but what I've decided to do today is examine this argument that has emerged in recent years about the relationship, if any, between multiculturalism and terrorism. So that's where we're heading. It may take a little while to get there. I'm an academic, you'll have to forgive me for that. I'm trained as a lawyer, so you'll really have to forgive me for that. But that's kind of where we're heading. And what I guess the starting point for this is just to make an observation about multiculturalism and the way we talk about it. The public discourse that surrounds multiculturalism is one that has actually changed quite radically in the last, how many years, probably 6 years. And not just the discourse around multiculturalism, but the discourse around migration generally has changed quite radically. Migration discourse, particularly anti-migrant discourse, tended to have an economic or cultural flavour. People who did funny things, cooked funny food, had too many people living in one house, dropped property prices in your area, took your jobs, that sort of rhetoric. That all changed, I think, and completely refreshed and renewed debates about multiculturalism on the 7th of July 2005, when the Tube in London was bombed in what we, I think, call the London bombings, but everyone else calls 7/7 after the date. And this was a really radical moment for our political conversation. It was, in many ways, and this might strike you as a controversial statement, but in many ways a more significant event than 9/11. Hey, you looked really surprised when I said that. Clearly it was controversial. 9/11 obviously has obvious significance. 3,000 people died, the biggest terrorist attack on US soil, possibly one of the biggest in human history, in terms of the numbers of lives lost. But 9/11, I think, was limited in its impact in two ways. I don't mean it was insignificant in its impact. It was clearly hugely significant. But there were limitations to its impact. One is that I think the way it looked meant that it was a totally different terrorism conversation to one that we would have previously. This was a terrorist attack that was cinematic. It looked surreal. It looked fictional. And there are probably many people in the world who still think it is fictional. But it was not your old style of terrorism, in that it wasn't something that had grit, something that intersected with your daily lives. It was a highly symbolic act. It was actually probably the most meticulously designed terrorist attack for the media age. It attacks a symbol that is clearly visible, And it's perfectly designed. You hit one tower, you wait 15 minutes for the cameras of the world to focus attention, and then you hit the second tower. And so you have probably the first time ever that a terrorist attack has been caught live. I don't think that's ever happened. It's not the nature of terrorist attacks. And that's gold for terrorists, because that's publicity. That's what you want. I've read a really interesting analysis about 9/11 from some academics who are actually looking at terrorism in film, so slightly different area. And one of the points they made was that 9/11, for a good while, killed off terrorist films as a genre, because there was nothing to say after that. There was nothing to escalate. 9/11 was so surreal, and films really gained their currency on creating scenarios that are surreal, that are beyond our experienced reality, which is what gets us excited. They don't usually put life on TV, unless they're perhaps making an adaptation of an Anton Chekhov novel or something, but I haven't seen that happen yet. So this is not the way that film proceeds. So 9/11 was this cinematic thing, but the other respect in which it was not significant, or not as significant as the London bombings, was that it still fit the old paradigm of terrorism as something that comes from without, as a problem that you essentially import. People come from other countries, either as migrants or just as visitors in some capacity. They come from outside and then they attack. And so in that way, it was a more comfortable thing to deal with than London, because London completely changed the paradigm. Now you had people born and raised locally who grew up and undertook terrorist attacks. And not domestic terrorist attacks. Terrorism from the homegrown population is actually not new, especially in the United States, as it happens, and it's still happening in the United States with probably a regularity that might surprise you. It just doesn't attract as much reporting. But this was odd, because it seemed like an international terrorist attack from within. And what it was really demonstrating was that the distinctions in a globalised world and in a cosmopolitan world, the distinctions between international and domestic are really breaking down, which is why some academics, mainly because they're fond of making up words, have started using words like intermestic. I'll leave it to you to decide whether or not that's useful or means anything. But it does attempt to capture something, that the boundary between what is domestic and what is international is blurred, and 9/11 really captured it. Sorry, the London bombings really captured that. But they introduced the homegrown terrorism idea, which was not an idea that we'd been preoccupied with, even though we'd had it in Australia. I mean, there had been terrorist attacks committed by Australians, but not for a long time and not of any huge significance in the way that 9/11 or the London bombings was. So this changed the discourse, and it set off a new conversation about multiculturalism. Suddenly, multiculturalism, which actually wasn't being discussed a huge amount, suddenly it moved from a conversation about the politics of culture and perhaps the politics of economics to a different conversation about the politics of security. It's not now that migrants were coming to steal our jobs, they were coming to kill us. And if they weren't, then their kids were. That's a very different tone of conversation all of a sudden. And so multiculturalism, I think, found itself in the dock in a way that it hadn't in the past, partly because there had been really quite a lull in Australian political conversation about multiculturalism in a way that was antagonistic to it. It had sort of just become almost an orthodoxy. That became radically called into question after the London bombings. The argument, really, into which multiculturalism was conscripted as a security discourse was an argument that multiculturalism has a causal link with terrorism, particularly homegrown terrorism, because what it does is create isolated subcultures and foment them. So isolated subcultures that are hostile to the host culture. That is, by giving up on any demand that migrants or people with migrant backgrounds, which is a very problematic way of describing people in Australia especially, but nonetheless, by giving up on the idea that such people should assimilate, and by putting forth a state policy that says that we all have the right to our own cultural attachments and we will celebrate that. What you do is you create a sociology of separateness. People who say, well, fine, it doesn't mean anything to be Australian anymore, so I won't be. What I will instead be is someone who's attached to my home culture, for want of a better phrase, and even where that becomes hostile to the majority and then leads to people blowing themselves up. Now, I have to say right up front that I think this argument has very little empirical evidence to demonstrate it. It's really a way of theorising about events based largely on pre-existing political dispositions. It was usually people who had not liked multiculturalism for quite a while now had a different way of attacking it. But nonetheless, the argument is there and it remains to be assessed. You may have picked up I'm not terribly sympathetic to it. I'll come to explain that in more detail. So this was the argument. Cultural separatism, subcultures that become hostile to the host culture, and also that this becomes a form of cultural surrender on the part of the majority culture. So the majority culture has now essentially relativised itself out of existence by virtue of embracing multiculturalism, which I think has been described maybe in one of the Australian newspapers as a cultural suicide pact. That was the kind of language that was being used. Now, to assess this argument, what we have to do is stop talking about multiculturalism for a moment and talk about terrorism. Try to gather or gain some kind of understanding of the dynamics of terrorism. What is exactly going on in the world of terrorism? How is it evolving? What are the forces at play within it? This is a very difficult thing to do in the 32 minutes I have left, and the less than that I have because I have to say other things after it. But I'll attempt to do this as quickly as I can, and also there will be time for questions, so we can go into more there. But the starting point, I guess, is to say, look, terrorism is not new. Depending on which book on the history of terrorism you read, it's been around for at least 2,000 years, probably longer. There are people who have called, I think it's Samson, the world's first suicide bomber. I'm not entirely convinced that that's true. You'd have to conduct an inquiry into the motivations of him bringing down the temple. I'm not sure it was political in nature, although that comes down to a definition of politics. In any way, I'm digressing. The point is, it's old. And in many histories of terrorism, the first terrorist group that will be mentioned are the Zealots of the first century, a Jewish group who were resisting Roman occupation. They were called the Sicarii. And the reason they were called the Sicarii, that's the Hebrew word or derived from the Hebrew word for dagger, because that was their weapon of choice. They used to go around the marketplace and stab other Jews who they felt were complicit with the Roman occupation. The idea was to end the occupation this way. So you had them, and then later on you had the Hashashin, a Shiite group from whom we get the word assassin. Hashashin actually means people who consume hashish. It's a kind of derogatory title that was given to them. And I don't actually know whether it was true that they consumed a lot of hashish, but nonetheless, there you are. And then another group that will be mentioned, a pre-modern group, is the Thuji. I think are possibly the longest surviving terrorist group in history, survived over several centuries in India, came from within the Hindu community, from whom we get the word thug. So I often say that terrorism has contributed significantly to the English language, if nothing else. But the point here is that it's old. Modern terrorism, though, begins in the 19th century with the anarchist wave out of Russia. That actually became an international wave. And then there are academic descriptions of the history of terrorism that divided into four waves subsequently to the anarchist wave. So the anarchist wave was the first one, then the post-colonial wave after World War I, and then the new left wave in around the 60s, where a lot of groups who tended to use sort of Marxist-type rhetoric. And a lot of the post-colonial groups that were still around started to adopt Marxist-type rhetoric around that time, because terrorism has its own fashion trends as well. And then what has been called the religious wave, which is really begins with the attack on the World Trade Centers in the 90s, or the sarin gas attacks in Tokyo, the Shinrikyo attacks, which a lot of people forget about, but actually very, very significant in signalling what people thought was a new kind of terrorism. What's interesting in that, and I say this just as an aside, is that the fact that you have a religious wave identified speaks to the fact that terrorism, modern terrorism especially, has been overwhelmingly secular in nature. That's typically who carried it out, even in places where it's now taken on a religious flavour, such as in the Palestinian territories. This, it's amazing to think that this even happened. In the 90s, Hamas issued a statement defending the charge that Muslims, particularly religious Muslims, were not engaged in the resistance against Israel, because it was the secular groups that were engaged in that resistance. It's hard to imagine Hamas having to release such a document now, that things have moved on. But this is quite a recent evolution. So that's just a very brief history. But as for the dynamics of the current terror threat that a nation like Australia faces, that's an interesting question, because here we run into probably the biggest debate amongst terrorism studies people and academics at the moment, and it's the Sageman versus Hoffman debate. Mark Sageman, who's one of the rock stars of terrorism studies, has come up with this idea that terrorism has evolved to be a leaderless phenomenon. This is a new development in terrorism. Typically, terrorist groups would be hierarchically structured, quite well organised, networked. You would understand who the leader was, who the second in command was, and then how that would feed down into a more or less conventional, basically corporate type structure. And so counter-terrorism was easy. You just sought the person that was highest up the chain that you could, and you took them out in one way or another. The person who detonated the bomb was not actually that important from a counter-terrorism point of view, maybe from a criminal justice point of view, but as far as counter-terrorism is concerned, that's not really the person you're after. The person you're after is higher up the chain. And if you can take out the CEO, then you take out the group, or go some way towards it. So Sageman is saying essentially that terrorism now is not conducted by, has evolved to the point where it's not conducted by groups that are networked in this way, have a clear leadership structure and so on. It's now conducted by groups of guys. That's not my paraphrasing, that's the term he uses, groups of guys theory. But this is what it's become. Part peer pressure, part antisocial behaviour and the sociology that's associated with that, and the psychology that's associated with that, but not people taking orders from field commander. In many ways, self-starting. Opposed to that is another rock star of terrorism studies, Bruce Hoffman, who has said essentially that if terrorism is leaderless, then I can retire from my job. It's of course it has a leadership and it's structured, and that's a very important thing to consider. The reality is that there are examples of both of these things in the world, and I suppose which side of the debate you fall on depends a little bit on which part of the world you're interested in and what groups and what attacks you're interested in. There are still old school terrorist groups that are active, or at least pretending to be active, that are networked. What Sageman, I guess, is focusing mainly on is this emerging thing of Al-Qaedaism. What's implicit in this, and this is important to understand, what's implicit in this is that if you take that view, then Al-Qaeda becomes pretty irrelevant. Except perhaps as a symbolic entity. But Al-Qaeda becomes meaningless. Not meaningless, but nowhere near as important as perhaps we think. If you could kill or demonstrate that Osama bin Laden had been killed, it would change nothing, really. In fact, it might make the problem worse, because you've now created someone who's even more symbolically potent than he was previously. Interesting question, actually. If you're advising President Obama and you know that Osama bin Laden is dead or has been killed, do you tell him to release that? Would you advise him to do that? What would the consequences of that be? Well, that's a difficult question, but your answer to that question probably indicates, to some extent, whether you're on Sagemann's side of the argument or Hoffman's side of the argument. And this is, what I'm doing is appallingly simplistic, but for this forum, it's the only way I can get through it. So, but that is nonetheless a very important, essential debate. What I want to say about it is that although particularly on the threat that is symbolised by Al-Qaeda, but is probably more accurately described in Jason Burke's terms as Al-Qaedaism. Focusing on that, I tend, and I'll say this by way of disclosure, I tend to be much more on Mark Sagemann's side than on Bruce Hoffman's side of the analysis. But, I mean, that's just disclosure, that's largely irrelevant. What I would say, though, in the case of Australia, it seems overwhelmingly true that the terror threat that's faced here is a leaderless phenomenon. So even if you believe that Hoffman's right, generally, by taking a global view, I don't believe you can say that with any real confidence about Australia and the threats that the Australian authorities are having to face. And my reasoning for that is that we have people who have been arrested and charged and some acquitted and some convicted. And in every case that's involved groups, I mean, there's the odd case of people who've made contact with Al-Qaeda, often Al-Qaeda Central, I mean, and often those people have left and have not carried out any attacks and are probably not occupying the thoughts of security agencies in the way that the other groups are. The groups that have been groups that have had plots that they wanted to carry out, or even if haven't had plots, have expressed desires to carry something out. These groups, overwhelmingly, we're seeing that they are disconnected from well-established terrorist groups. They're not really part of them. They don't really have contacts with them. Even in cases where people have supposed that there were contacts. I'm thinking here, not in Australia, but of the Times Square bombing plot that obviously failed, that Faisal Shahzad was trying to carry out. You might remember there was an early suggestion that this was the work of the Pakistani Taliban, and then there was a suggestion that he'd been to Pakistan and trained with them, and so that he was an agent of the Pakistani Taliban. In the end, it happened, and he said it as much in court, more or less after we'd figured it out anyway, that he wasn't an agent of anybody. Yes, he'd been there, and he'd got some training, clearly not very good training, but he was not acting for them. This was a self-starting thing. He is unusual in the world of terrorism in that he's a lone wolf, which is odd. Terrorism is usually a group activity, and there's important psychological reasons for that, because you need the process of escalation in a group to carry out those sorts of attacks often. But he is representative of this leaderless phenomenon, in that this is self-starting, perhaps plugging in at times to an infrastructure that's out there, but not necessarily, and not following orders. There is nobody that you could take out to have prevented him from acting that way. And in Australia we see a similar phenomenon, even where there was some suggestion that links were being created between people in Australia and Al-Shabaab in Somalia. It turned out those links were basically non-existent. And if they were existent at all, were meaningless, really. Al-Shabaab themselves said, we don't know who these people are. So, which is incidentally not something that terrorist groups would say for no reason. Usually they'll claim everything they can, right? It's part of the point of propaganda by deed. That's what the original anarchists called terrorism. So this is one of the characteristics of the contemporary terrorist threat, that it is decentralised radically. It has no particular leader. It does not take orders from anyone in particular. Nobody is in control of it. There is no one that can give the order for it to stop. It is a essentially self-starting activity that is deeply embedded, I would say irrevocably embedded, in the structures of globalisation. This sort of terrorism really could not have existed in a pre-globalised age. Here, something like Al-Qaeda becomes important more for the videos it releases online than for attacks that it tries to carry out. If you trace attacks that Al-Qaeda has committed, you find they're actually relatively few. Which is why, and this is the way to spot it, in media reports, they'll often talk about Al-Qaeda linked or Al-Qaeda inspired or something like that, because that's really the only way to try to describe it. But even those attacks that are often described as Al-Qaeda linked are not really. Some of them are. But really what they are is they're linked by global media, global communications. Bin Laden, one of Bin Laden's most important roles really is as a filmmaker, as a motivational speaker. He sends out messages into the world, and he doesn't have any control over what people are going to do with them, but there is a hope that it will inspire some level of action, an action that he approves with. But he's not a head of a terrorist organisation that is vast and global and has the capacity to strike anywhere. That's not really the way it's working. Nobody's in control of that. It's not to say that we're not dealing with something that is vast and global and could potentially strike anywhere. It's just that no one's in charge of it. That's not a comforting thought, but that is nonetheless, at least the way I read the situation. Another important feature of this is that unlike terrorism throughout history, and particularly through modern history, this is a form of terrorism that is not necessarily anchored in the nation state. So traditionally, the way a terrorist group would act is they would act for a patch of land, either to try to change the government that presides over it, or to secede from a government that presides over it. So separatist terrorism or revolutionary terrorism. And the conduct of the terrorist group was overwhelmingly concentrated in the nation state and confined to that logic. One of the key features of Al-Qaedaism is it's not. It's global. And why I say global, not international. Because international, although that's a very common word to describe, it's not a word I favour, because international still has embedded within it Westphalian logic. It's still about the logic of the nation state. It still talks about an entity that exists in or between states. Al-Qaedaism doesn't do that. It seeks to bypass the nation state really as an organising principle for politics. It will attack the nation state because it's there to be attacked. I mean, it's an important part of the political reality, but it's not necessarily the analytical mode of global terrorism. That's why I think it's global. Now, what that means is that in order to come to terms with this, we need to understand the narrative that informs it, that drives it. Narrative isn't everything, but in the case of global terrorism, it's a good deal of it. Because it's the narrative, actually, that makes it global. It's the narrative that helps it exist as a decentralised phenomenon. Narratives are important in traditional terrorist groups as well. You need to inspire whatever group of people you've got. But in a traditional terrorist group, hierarchy and command is just as important. In this sort of terrorist group, that's not necessarily the case, because there's no hierarchy. No clear hierarchy, anyway. It's often described as a very flat or horizontally structured phenomenon. So narrative is crucial. The question to ask is, what is the narrative that has led to this sort of evolution where terrorism itself has globalised? That's a long conversation, but in short, it stems from the failure of domestic terrorism, from nation-based terrorism, throughout the Muslim world. It had been tried. Don't forget this. And the early religious terrorist groups, so the early Islamist terrorist groups, were also nationally focused. Groups like the Gamal Islamiyya in Egypt or Islamic Jihad, these sorts of groups. The focus was to Islamicise the Egyptian state. They assassinated a president. They murdered tourists. Why would you murder tourists in Egypt? Well, because how else are you going to cripple the economy in the hope of triggering a revolution. Now, as it happened, it didn't work out so well. They assassinated a president, not much changed. They killed a whole lot of tourists at the Temple of Hatshepsut in Luxor in, I think it was in 97, a lot of European tourists. It did hurt the economy, and Egyptians largely blamed the terrorists, not the government. They didn't like the government, as we've recently discovered, but they didn't blame the government for that. So nation-based terrorism, or what we might call traditional forms of terrorism or Westphalian terrorism, failed. It didn't really work. At the same time, you have a group of people who were called, and I think called themselves, the Mujahideen, in Afghanistan, fighting the Soviets, contributing to the fighting of the Soviets. I think a lot of Afghans don't think they did a lot, actually. But nonetheless, they were there. With US support as part of a proxy war against a Cold War enemy. And here are the beginnings of the globalisation of this terrorist movement. Among them are people like bin Laden. And suddenly you have people who become internationally connected, but who have global horizons here. They weren't really fighting for Afghanistan. They were fighting for this global Muslim community. This was the beginning of a very important, really new in contemporary politics, idea. A global community that you would act on behalf of. And so you develop this narrative, which is very clear, I think, when you actually read the statements of bin Laden, for example, which very few people do. And I think that's part of the problem, actually. Not that it's good reading. In fact, it's thoroughly boring reading. But what we know about bin Laden tends to be what others say about him. And what we know about his motivations, what we know about why he says he's doing it, often doesn't come from him. When you read through it, apart from getting through the boredom of it, it actually becomes pretty mundane and pretty clear. This rhetoric develops about the near enemy and the far enemy. So the near enemy being the dictatorships in the Muslim heartlands, the Middle East. Remember, bin Laden began as a Saudi dissident, whose aim was to get rid of the Saudi royal family. But eventually, he and others that have been through a similar sort of experience develop this narrative that says, well, the reason you can murder or assassinate a president and nothing changes is because this is not a national phenomenon you're dealing with. This is a global phenomenon. The dictators that you hate, that you want to get rid of, are supported by Washington. If you want to get rid of them, therefore, you have to strike Washington. The attempt is really to change the near enemy, but the argument's now globalised. The struggle is now global because the only way you can change the near enemy is to attack the far enemy. And there's other discourse, other rhetoric about how the nation state itself is something that keeps Muslims, this global community of Muslims, which doesn't really exist and never really has, but is keeping this community weak and oppressed and divided. Why is it that you have Muslims sitting on untold riches of oil in the Middle East and you have other Muslims starving in Africa? Why is that? Well, it's because of this nation-state model that keeps them divided, makes them compete against one another. Where did that nation-state model come from? Well, it came from colonisation. So here is now the narrative. It's historical, it's global, it explains a lot, and it provides a template for action that is global, which is important, where things that are national have failed. And hence, it becomes the next wave, the next evolutionary step in contemporary terrorism. But it needs a global narrative. It needs something that actually really is global. How do you explain how it appeals, for instance, to Muslims living in the West? And here it gets interesting. So the argument essentially becomes the reason that the far enemy is conspiring against the Muslims to keep them divided and so on. The reason that's happening is because really there exists a vast global conspiracy against Muslims everywhere. They just don't like Muslims. And so they want to wipe them out, essentially, if they can, or at least dominate them. Now, that domination took the form of colonisation. But you will find a young Muslim audience member who lives in a Western nation, you will find that they are no less contemptible, they're no less contemptuous of you. You will find that ultimately the alienation and oppression and sense of humiliation that you feel in your society exists because that's the way the world works. And that what you experience is different really only in degree, not in essence, from the experience of the Muslim in the Palestinian territories or Chechnya or Kashmir or southern Philippines or southern Thailand or previously in the Balkans. It's a really interesting narrative. Because what it's doing is creating not necessarily an equivalence but a clear theoretical continuity between the localized experience of someone living in a Western nation, never been to the Muslim world necessarily, doesn't have a historical connection, they might be Pakistani origin, but they care about Iraq. Certainly not a national or Westphalian connection, but they have a globalized connection that's based on a shared sense of identity. And that connects their local experience to global experiences that they may be upset about. It's one thing to observe what's happening in Chechnya, for instance, and be upset about it. It's something else entirely and something else much more powerful to connect that to your experience and say that they come from the same place. An example that illustrates that, I guess, is you might remember the murder of Theo van Gogh, the filmmaker in the Netherlands. It's often described as a murder. Really, it's a terrorist attack. The reason it's a terrorist attack was it had clear political motivations. And Mohamed Bouyeri, who was the man who carried out that attack, North African descent, living in the Netherlands, didn't really actually want to kill Theo van Gogh. His primary target was actually to find a Dutch politician. But that proved too difficult, so he targeted Theo van Gogh anyway, instead. It's like more as a substitute. He was really upset at the way that Dutch politics had evolved. He, as far as he was concerned, Dutch politics had taken a really strongly anti-Muslim flavour. Lots of immigrants had been deported suddenly. People who'd been living in the Netherlands for 5 years, I think it was like somewhere in the order of 20,000 people suddenly deported like this. Rhetoric, anti-Muslim rhetoric in the Netherlands was growing steadily. So he has this experience of alienation. This is a society that doesn't want me. And he goes online. And he starts running into this sort of narrative that I was explaining online, explaining his frustration, his anger in global terms that make it very, very significant globally now. It's not just about me and my life that I don't like. It's about this global phenomenon now. And give him a plan for action, really. And so this connection between his real-world experience and these ideas that he confronts in the virtual world have an impact on his identity in the way that he chooses to form it and ultimately the way he chooses to express it through violence. And so instead of being some kid who's upset about living in the Netherlands or about Dutch society or something like that, he's now a soldier in a global war. That sounds much more grandiose. That's a much more significant sense of purpose, and hence the appeal. So identity is really crucial, because what's implicit in the global terrorist narrative is that you essentially choose which one identity you want to have. You can be Muslim, or you can be Dutch or British or Australian or American, whatever it is, but you can't be both. And the reason you can't be both is because they will never have you. And because that other identity, that national identity that they are urging you to take on, is ultimately, particularly in Europe, a product of colonisation and a way of trying to beat the Islam out of you. It's ultimately what it is in this narrative. Now, that means, it seems to me, that the most potent message that could be internalised that would resist that narrative or make it less effective through a series of social experiences and public rhetoric is one that emphasises the possibility, in fact, celebrates the possibility of what I call dual authenticity. That is, not one that presents you with a false choice. Well, you may not think it's false, but not one that presents you with a choice between one or the other, but one that accepts the possibility of realising both in an authentic way. Now, this is a tricky thing to realise. It's a tricky message to send, but I think the imperative for it is reasonably clear. The alternative, which says you choose one or the other, essentially an assimilationist kind of politics, and here you see, I will come back to the topic, I will get there. This assimilationist kind of politics, essentially, what it does is it presents you with that choice, just from the other end. So whereas the global terrorist narrative says, you have this identity choice to make, you can't do both, you have this identity choice and you must choose, it is incumbent upon you to choose your identity as a Muslim as part of the effort that's required of you to liberate the Muslim world from the yoke of oppression. And it's important to remember this is a liberation discourse, actually. That's one choice that's being urged upon you. If the other choice is, well, no, you must choose your national identity essentially at the expense of any other identities or prioritise it above, not that they can be synthesised or that they can coexist, but that this is about priority. One must crowd out the other to some extent. If that's the message, then the risk you run is that not everyone will choose your side. Some will, no doubt about that, but not everyone will. Here's the way that identity works. Identity has a very intimate relationship with vulnerability. You all have multiple identities. I'm not diagnosing you with some kind of psychiatric disorder. It's a fact of your life. You can't help it. You have national identities, varying strengths. Some of you may not identify strongly with your nation, others might. But it's part of who you are. You have identities as parents, as children of parents, as people who work in particular sectors, as people who barrack for certain football teams, as people who have had certain educational experiences, people who live in a particular suburb, as people who have certain ethnicities. These are all aspects of your identity. What is it that makes you choose one aspect to express over another? I mean, it's not a conscious choice necessarily. One just seems more important to you than another at a particular point in time. Well, there are many things that could do that, but what I want to submit before you is that one of the things that is crucial is your sense of vulnerability about a particular aspect of your identity. If some aspect of your identity suddenly becomes a site for attack or threat, physical or emotional or otherwise, it starts to matter. And you cling to it. Or you reject it. So the best way I can think to illustrate this is a woman that I know who does cross-cultural training for corporations, which last time I heard a talk about it, I think means explaining to corporations how not to offend potential clients in Asia. But she's an interesting case. She's Scottish and she's Catholic. When she lived in, this is her story, as she tells it, this is not my projection. She grew up in Scotland. She knew she was Catholic. She was made to feel that. She then moved from Scotland to the north of England. There, people didn't mind so much that she was Catholic, but she was very Scottish. She then moved from the north of England to one of the elite universities, and I never remember this, even though she's told me several times. It's either Oxford or Cambridge. And there, no one really cared that she was Catholic, and no one really cared that she was Scottish, but they found it rather intriguing that she was working class. And through each stage of this journey, different aspects of who she was mattered to her differently. Proud to be Scottish. Proud to be Catholic. Proud to be working class. To this day, my wife will not stop attacking me for having completed my schooling just 2 years at a private school. Because she's at university, she's an academic herself from a state school. It really matters. Why? Because there aren't that many state school kids there. Everyone else from a private school. This is something that marks her out as different. Now, if you're in a situation where some aspect of yourself is highlighted and makes you vulnerable, then you start to do something. You will either emphasise it, often in a quite assertive, sometimes even aggressive way. Perhaps get cocky about it. Or you completely deny it. It's not me. And anyone who knows a migrant community knows this, sees this happen. Jamal becomes Jim. You know, Malik becomes Mike. All of these things happen because there's a vulnerability there. So some just shun it and some embrace it. Right, you mark me out for difference? All right, I'm different. And now I'm going to explain to you why my difference makes me better than you. You have a choice. I mean, those two responses will happen. So if you give people that choice, you'll get both. The problem when you start thinking about this in a context of terrorism is you don't need many. And this, I think, is the problem with assimilationist politics, is it doesn't understand the impact that it has on identity formation. And it doesn't understand that often the result of it is the very opposite of the thing that it claims to be trying to achieve. It may not get multiculturalism through assimilation. What you will get is parallel monoculturalism. People just forming enclaves because it's easier. They'll form the path, follow the path of least resistance. If I'm going to come into a country and essentially be told I have to give up on all these other aspects of myself, as though any of us in Australia would actually do that if we left. But if that's what's going to happen, and everywhere I go, it's going to be a problem, and everywhere I go, politicians are going to talk about it, fine. I'll live in a neighbourhood with a whole lot of people who are just as weird as me, we'll talk our own funny language, cook our own funny foods, and we'll be perfectly happy. One of the things that staggered me most was in 2005, I think it was, when there were riots in France. People of North African descent were still called immigrants, despite the fact they're third generation, sometimes more. When that happened, I read a rash of commentary about the failures of multiculturalism, as though the French had ever been multiculturalist. I'm not saying that as a derogatory statement, it's an avowedly assimilationist nation. But none of that assimilation had caused a great deal of French pride in the hearts of these people. Why? Because that's the way that identity formation works. I have no doubt there are plenty of North African or people of North African descent in France who are proudly French and say, I'm not North African, I'm French. No doubt. They're not the ones rioting, probably. I don't know that you get to make the choice. And so this is where I think multiculturalism comes into its own as part of the conversation. Not as something that foments and causes terrorism in a way that's, I think, empirically difficult to identify and explain. and demonstrate. And not necessarily as the solution to all problems of terrorism, but as something that might at least ameliorate a very important aspect of the radicalisation process of this particular form of terrorism, this highly decentralised, we might even call it postmodern form of terrorism that currently occupies Australia's thoughts. Could be. I note, and this is interesting to note, although there is an emerging trend in the United States which is worrying, but I note that despite the fact that so many of the grievances that occupy the minds of those promulgating the global terrorist narrative, despite the fact that most of those grievances emanate in one way or another from the United States, the United States has, per capita, far less of a problem with homegrown radicalisation than Europe does. Interesting to think about. Does the United States have a policy of multiculturalism? Not really. It has a policy that goes beyond multiculturalism. The state does not get involved in determining culture. That's the big state. If it does, people in the South and people in the West and people in the Northwest and the Pacific West and in New England, they're all going to go to war. Which culture is going to win? It's an interesting thing to think about. And Australia, I think, sits somewhere in between. We don't have the baggage of the old world that Europe has. And so these questions of identity, we have a lot more flexibility than Europe has, and therefore we're less locked into the radicalisation cycle that I think Europe suffers from in a way that is worrying, and I don't deny that. It's time for me to shut up, and it's time for you to throw things at me. So I'll hand over to questions. Do I moderate the questions, or do you?
Well, first of all, we give you a round of applause.
Ah, right.
Then I invite anyone with a particularly incisive question to come to one of the microphones and to ask it briefly. There's a microphone up the back in the aisle if you want to just pop up there.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. My name's Shobha Vaki and I wear very many identities, but I don't have a crisis of identity. I think we should debate this for a couple of days. I've got so much to talk, so I'm going to keep it short. From my perspective, multiculturalism should be celebrated, embraced, be a very positive, and I think in Australia we can show the world how to have multiculturalism as a very positive force in our world. Assimilation, I detest the word. I see it as a dominant culture trying to overpower other cultures, and I would not hold it in the same breath as multiculturalism. And terrorism, I've experienced it firsthand when I worked with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Sri Lanka, and the LTTE were a terrorist organization, and they had women and children in their terrorist organization. My question to you is, how can we discuss multiculturalism and focus it only on multiculturalism and how positive it is, rather than even disdaining it and tainting it with the word terrorism? I don't see them in the same sentence personally. So could you give us some positive way forward for multiculturalism? Just that. Thank you.
Well, that should be easy. I think the short answer to your question is you can't. I mean, you can't quarantine the conversation that way. You can't. There's no way I can think of or would necessarily even desire that says that we'll only be able to talk about it in these celebratory terms. I think multiculturalism, while I am generally sympathetic to your position because I do like multiculturalism, although for me it depends a bit on how you define it. It's something that remains like any government policy, or even not a government policy, even any fact of life, it remains open to critique. I've read lots of interesting critiques of multiculturalism, critiques such as they don't like multiculturalism because it doesn't pay sufficient respect to cultural minorities because it gives them only a negative form of recognition, a kind of tolerance rather than a kind of celebration and acceptance. There's a critique of multiculturalism. It's a different one from the critique that we often hear, but it's a critique nonetheless. So my point is that these things can be critiqued, and I think it's fair enough to do that. I think what needs to happen, though, especially to those who are sympathetic towards multiculturalism, and I would not assume that everyone in the room is, or even most, but I think what needs to happen is that the arguments about it need to proceed on the basis of some kind of understanding of human nature. And that's where they fail resoundingly, in my view, the anti-multiculturalist arguments. Because I think what they do is they demand conduct and attitudes of people, of other people, that they would never be up for themselves. I'm quite happy to have that argument. And I think that we should be happy to have it as a society, if need be. The problem I have is not with the debate. The problem is that the debate often gets to proceed without any sense.
My name's Ernst Wilhelm. I'd like to thank you, first of all, for such a stimulating and thought-provoking address, and ask you to comment on the possible implications of your view of terrorism, that it's essentially leaderless, for our refugee policies. We keep refugees who come by boat in detention for two purposes. First of all, to determine whether they are in genuine fear of persecution, and that's usually determined fairly quickly, as I understand it. But then we keep them for prolonged periods for security assessments, which seem to be very difficult to undertake and seem to take a very long time. During that period of detention, there seems to be a growth of radicalisation because people become so frustrated at being kept in detention for such prolonged periods. In light of your comments about terrorism, do you think our policy is misguided and counterproductive?
From a counterterrorism point of view?
Yes.
So everyone wants to ask an easy question. I think the policy is misguided anyway. And I think the level of frustration that asylum seekers are experiencing is misunderstood, because what we often don't understand is not just the waiting here, they've often got on boats because they've been waiting in Indonesia, having been processed by the UNHCR for years and years, and then not resettled. So there's frustration upon frustration. The counter-terrorism argument, or the issue about its relationship to counter-terrorism, I don't think is actually about the refugees themselves. What's implicit, I didn't make it explicit, but what is implicit in the leaderless phenomenon of terrorism is that you move from a world that was quite easily characterized or contained by the application of hard power to a world where suddenly everything has symbolism, and that symbolism really matters because you're into a whole murky territory of identity formation and psychology and socialization and experience and social psychology. Everything's symbolic in that world. So from a counter-terrorism point of view, I'm not so worried about refugees experiencing a hard time. They'll become radicalised maybe in the detention centre because they want to get out. But my experience with refugees, and I don't claim to have vast experience, but I've got a bit, my experience with them is that once they're out, they're just happy to be out and they want to get their heads down and get on with life. It's what the imagery of the policy is like to those watching. Now, what is that imagery? That's really complicated because in my experience in migrant communities, some of the most staunch anti-asylum seeker rhetoric comes from migrants. So it's not easy to say, well, one leads to this will alienate a whole lot of people. It's a question of whether or not they look at the asylum seeker and identify that that in some way represents them. Now, for Muslims, there is every risk of that. Why are we bashing up on these asylum seekers? Well, it's because they're Muslims. Fits with everything else. All right. You can see how the narrative gets constructed. A more serious example, I think, than the asylum seeker one, because I'm not yet to see that as a really radicalising symbol. But a more serious one in my view was the Muhammad Hanif case. How many people of South Asian extraction, or not even of South Asian extraction, would have lent a SIM card to a cousin when they were overseas together? Probably thousands, if not millions, in Australia. How many would look at someone like Muhammad Hanif, about whom it transpired there was nothing, and say, that could have been me? Hard to put a number on that. How does that feed into the narrative that they're out to get you and it's not really about anything? There's nothing you can say or do that's going to... Well, for some people, it will feed in very strongly. For other people, not. It actually depends a little bit on their state of mind and their social experience to that point. But that's the kind of symbolism, I think, that bothers me a bit more from a counter-terrorism point of view. We're meant to stop. I'm happy to keep going, but I know that you run things according to time in this place. So.
If there's a quick question, we can have time for one more. Is yours a quick question, sir? Would you like to go to the microphone? A quick and easy question.
Easy question too?
Yes, no would be right. Good.
Thank you very much, Waleed. My name is Muhammad Ali and I'm president of Forum Australia. Canberra-based organisation started in 2005. And we regularly, under the auspices of Forum Australia, under this umbrella, keep on discussing issues that concern all Australians and Muslims as well. My question, correct me if I'm wrong, you said that it's hard to keep two identities. It's hard, that means, to be an American Muslim. It's hard to be a European Muslim these days.
No, that's not what I said.
Do you think that it's equally hard to be an Australian Muslim also?
No, I don't think it's hard at all. I don't think it's hard to maintain those two identities. I think what's hard is to change the tide of the political conversation to one that recognises implicitly and explicitly that dual authenticity is possible and that provides the social conditions for it. I think we tend to fall into the trap in our public discourse that says, well, you can sort of be both, but you've got to be one first. I think it's actually a ridiculous question, particularly when we talk about religion, because it's not a question that... religion and nationality actually exist in totally different realms. I mean, I don't ask... Do we have any doctors in the room? No, they're all in the surgery. Any sort of doctor, okay. Do we have any retirees in the room? I was told that would work. Okay. I don't ask you, are you a retiree or an Australian first? To ask that question sounds absurd because it's like, what do you mean? I'm perfectly capable of being both. The reason the question gets asked about Muslims is because there's an assumption that their intention and that at one level or another, they kind of have to be. And so you have to prioritise one over the other. That's very difficult logic in our conversation to change, particularly in a conversation that's dominated by national politicians whose frame of reference for everything is going to be Westphalian, it's going to be the nation state. So that's difficult. But your question about can you be an Australian and Muslim at the same time, I don't think it's not actually a question for most Australian Muslims. At least it wasn't until it became a big social question and they said, well, maybe I can't be. I had people who... doing well, like small business owners running successful businesses, telling me, Muslims, either born here or came here very young, telling me, I was integrated, now I'm disintegrating. That's something to think about, I think.
Well, on that note, can we thank you very much for the absolute brilliant... The people have spoken. We loved it. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you all.